The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from the Week magazine dated January 25th, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today. Our first item from the main story section of the week is Obama takes on the NRA. What happened? President Obama this past week unveiled sweeping gun control legislation to stem the epidemic of gun violence, setting up a fierce clash with pro-gun lobbyists and congressional legislators. Flanked by children who wrote to him in the wake of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, the president called on Congress to swiftly implement universal background checks on all gun buyers, reinstate an expired ban on military-style assault rifles, and restore a 10-round limit on ammunition magazines. Obama also outlined 23 executive orders he would sign immediately, including ending a freeze on research into gun violence and improving mental health and school safety programs. If there is even one thing we can do to reduce this violence, if there's even one life that can be saved, then we've got an obligation to try, Obama said. The proposals will face strong opposition in Congress. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada has said that he doesn't believe a ban on assault weapons could pass the Republican-controlled House and wasn't confident that it would pass the Senate. And in a sign of the bitter fight to come, the powerful National Rifle Association sent out an urgent fundraising appeal to its 4 million members, saying, "This is the fight of the century," and simultaneously launched a scathing TV advertising campaign. The ad accused the president of being an elitist hypocrite for having armed Secret Service agents protect his two daughters while opposing armed guards at the nation's schools. The White House denounced the ad as a repugnant and cowardly. Now here's what the editorial said. Obama's grandiose proposals would trample the rights of law-abiding citizens without doing anything to prevent mass shootings, said the Detroit News. If these bans had been in place last year, Adam Lanza would still have been able to use his mom's legally obtained guns to massacre kids at an unguarded school. In 1999, it was illegal to sell assault weapons, yet the Columbine school shootings happened anyway. The phrase assault weapons is meaningless, said NationalReview.com. Such weapons are functionally indistinguishable from any semi-automatic hunting rifle, which even Obama wouldn't dare to ban. His proposals are nothing more than gun control theater. Actually, this legislative package could save a lot of lives, said the New York Times. Because of loopholes in the law, up to 40% of gun sales take place without background checks, including most guns that are later used in crimes. Requiring background checks at gun shows, online arms stores, and other private sales would reduce the cash and carry anonymity of millions of gun transactions and would have no effect on law-abiding citizens who want a hunting rifle or a handgun to keep at home. Now here's what the columnist said. If Congress does nothing else, it should ban high-capacity magazines, said George Gaskin in Politico.com. In every one of the 22 mass shootings between 1984 and 2011, the killer used a clip that carried more than 10 bullets. Those oversized magazines enabled the shooters to collectively fire more than 1,500 rounds in schools, workplaces, churches, and other public places, murdering 225 people and wounding 242 more. Bystanders or police were able to overpower the shooters only when they stopped to reload. There is no need in civil society for such weapons of mass destruction. Every American has a fundamental right to own such weapons, said Eric Erickson in RedState.com. The nation's founders were revolutionaries who wrote the Second Amendment not just to enable Americans to ward off burglars, but to give them the ability to overthrow tyrannical governments. You may think a 30-round magazine is too big. Under the real purpose of the Second Amendment, a 30-round magazine might be too small. In the NRA, Obama is taking on a very formidable opponent, said Ron Fournier in TheAtlantic.com. The organization will threaten every red state and rural congressman and woman with the loss of their jobs if they vote for the president's proposals, and the odds are stacked against him. Obama admitted that this week, saying the only way gun laws will change is if the American people demand it. Now we'll find out if they do. The next item from the main story section of the Week magazine this week is called A Test of Wills on the Debt Ceiling. President Obama and the Republican House this past week ratcheted up their confrontational rhetoric on the government's borrowing limit, raising the real possibility that the U.S. government will go into default in just a few weeks. The government is expected to reach the $16.4 trillion debt ceiling in late February or early March. If Congress does not authorize the federal government to borrow more money before then, it could run out of available funds and halt payments to creditors, sending shockwaves through stock markets, damaging U.S. credit ratings, and leaving Social Security checks unsent. Republicans say they will not raise the debt ceiling unless Obama agrees to a dollar in spending cuts for every dollar the ceiling is raised, which will likely be $1 trillion. But the president this week insisted that while he's open to a bargain on a balanced new deficit reduction package, he would refuse to negotiate with Republicans if they use the debt ceiling as leverage. They will not collect a ransom in exchange for not crashing the American economy, Obama said. Obama ruled out several widely discussed options for unilaterally raising the debt ceiling without Congress's approval. That sets the stage for a battle of wills with Republicans. House Republican Conference Chairwoman Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State told Politico.com that her party is tired of kicking the deficit reduction can down the road. I think it is possible that we should shut down the government to make sure President Obama understands that we're serious, she said. Now here's what the editorial said. So once again, we creep closer to default, said Bloomberg.com, thanks to a Republican Party whose hostage-taking has repeatedly paralyzed the U.S. and threatened to derail the economy. The last standoff in August of 2011 forced credit rating agency Standard & Poor's to downgrade the U.S. government's credit rating. How much damage to this nation are Republicans willing to do? The GOP seems caught in a downward spiral, said USA Today. The more voters punish them for their stubborn obstructionism, the worse it gets. This is no way to run a party. But it's the Democrats who are truly irresponsible here, said NationalReview.com. Despite a federal deficit that's climbed to $1 trillion a year, they're content to borrow and spend indefinitely and are using the debt ceiling fight to distract the press and the public from the reality of our fiscal crisis. Now that we've once again run out of borrowed money, it's time to agree to a plan that gets government spending under control. Now here's what the columnist said. Forcing the U.S. government to default would backfire on Republicans, said Ross Douthat in New York Times. The president inevitably has the upper hand in these power struggles, as Newt Gingrich found out the hard way in the 1995 government shutdown. If congressional Republicans elect to cause an economic crisis, the GOP will be so politically damaged that it will only lead to a stronger Democratic Party, a more powerful liberalism, and a more expansive state. Obama is well aware of that, which is why he's finally getting tough, said Jacob Weisberg in Slate.com. He's been shorn of his fantasies of compromise and prefers to challenge House Speaker John Boehner rather than beat his head against a wall of wingnut opposition. Having won a victory in the fiscal cliff negotiations, the president is betting that the enfeebled Boehner and his perfervid Frank and File will blink first. It's more likely that Obama will blink first, said Daniel Foster at NationalReview.com. He knows there is a faction of the House Republican caucus with an appetite, nay, a bloodlust, for a government shutdown. If Boehner uses the foamy-mouthed Rottweiler of the hardliners to make Obama sweat, some spending cuts are likely to wind up on the negotiating table. Don't bet the country on it, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. By repeatedly ruling out negotiations, Obama has left himself no room to backslide. While House conservatives truly believe this is their last chance to save America from Greek, Kenyan, socialist hell. For 2 years, Obama and the Republicans have been playing a dangerous game of chicken. This time it may end in a head-on collision. Now the controversy of the week from the Week magazine, Obama's cabinet, a team of liberal yes-men. Say goodbye to the team of rivals, said Scott Wilson in the Washington Post. President Obama's second-term cabinet is shaping up as a band of brothers, an insular inner circle of male loyalists. When Obama took office in 2009, he was widely praised for bringing in a diverse group of cabinet officials with contrarian tendencies. Obama asked his bitter rival for the Democratic nomination, Hillary Clinton, to be his Secretary of State. Selected Wall Street insider Tim Geithner to be Treasury Secretary and even kept Republican Bob Gates at defense. But 4 years later, convinced that he'll have but a year or two to effectively push his agenda, Obama would appear to have lost his appetite for internal debate and political drama. Now that he's free from the constraints of public opinion, said Seth Mandel in CommentaryMagazine.com, Obama is hiring doctrinaire liberals he knows and trusts. John Kerry for State, Chuck Hagel for Defense, Jack Lew for Treasury, and John Brennan for the CIA. 4 years in the Oval Office has left Obama supremely confident of his own views on foreign policy, the budget, intelligence, and everything else on planet Earth. So instead of the best, smartest people who can bring original ideas to the table, he is hiring yes men. Prepare the articles of impeachment, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. The President of the United States is brazenly trying to fill his cabinet with people he likes, and in a further assault on our democracy, is even nominating people who agree with his policies. Seriously, has there ever been a weaker or weirder criticism of Obama than this latest attack? In one more sign of Republican derangement, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, they're complaining that nominees Lew and Hagel do not agree with Republicans on public policy issues. Yet you read that, yes, you read that correctly. The GOP says highly experienced, obviously qualified candidates are unfit to implement Obama's policy agenda because they agree with Obama's policy agenda. Let Obama have his yes men, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, but where are the women? With Clinton and Labor Secretary Hilda Solis retiring, Obama's second-term cabinet so far is a bunch of white dudes. The White House last week released a photo of Obama and 11 of his closest advisors, and 10 are men. Maybe Obama should ask Mitt Romney for his binders full of women, said Margaret Carlson in Bloomberg.com. Not incidentally, of those 10 male advisors, only one is a minority. Obama may be our first African-American president, but his chorus of trusted confidants looks more like the Augusta National Golf Club than America. Some perspective, please, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. Obama's obviously not a racist, and on women's issues such as contraception, equal pay, and the Violence Against Women's Act, he has proven his feminist credentials. His cabinet picks aren't done, and you can be sure that there will be some women and minorities in the next batch. Of the last four secretaries of state, three were women and two were black, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. Now a white man will apparently serve in the post. So what? A president should pick cabinet members based on their talent and qualifications. As conservatives, we don't like Obama's cabinet choices, and we believe that, with their help, the president will repeatedly get it wrong over the next 4 years. But it won't be because of his lack of enthusiasm for diversity. Now, from the main story section of the Week magazine, we'll turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for galactic peace. After the Obama administration rejected an online petition for a real-life version of the Star Wars Death Star, the White House cited the $850 quadrillion construction cost. It was a good week for putting in your 2 cents after Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas broke his 7-year silence at oral arguments to crack a joke. But because several other justices were also talking at the same time, the official transcript only quotes Thomas saying, quote, "Well, he did not," followed by laughter. It was a good week for extra padding after a 400-pound woman who crashed through a New York City sidewalk survived because her girth cushioned her fall. They said that my size was the only thing that saved me, Alonda Williams said. It was a bad week for natural gas after the Social Security Administration issued, then retracted, an official reprimand to a flatulent staff member. The worker was told that his gas passing constituted conduct unbecoming a federal employee until higher-ups withdrew the rebuke. It was a bad week for Oxygen Media after public disgust prompted the cable TV network to pull a new reality TV show called All My Baby's Mamas about a rap artist who has 11 children with 10 women. And it was a bad week for following instructions after a faulty car navigation system sent a Belgian woman on an 1,800-mile detour through 6 countries. Sabine Moreau, 67, had intended to drive 93 miles to Brussels, but ended up in Croatia. "Suddenly I appeared in Zagreb," she said, "and I realized I wasn't in Belgium anymore." Now, from the main story section and Good Week For and Bad Week For, we'll turn to the briefing in the Week magazine for this week. This week's briefing is entitled The Switches on Your Genes. New research suggests that people's experiences, not just their genes, can affect the biological legacy of their offspring. Isn't our genetic legacy hardwired? From Mendel and Darwin in the 19th century to Watson and Crick in the 20th century, scientists have shown that chromosomes passed from parent to child form a genetic blueprint for development. But in a quiet scientific revolution, researchers have in recent years come to realize that genes aren't a fixed, predetermined program simply passed from one generation to the next. Instead, genes can be turned on and off by experiences and environment. What we eat, how much stress we undergo, and what toxins we're exposed to can all alter the genetic legacy we pass on to our children and even grandchildren. In this new science of epigenetics, researchers are exploring how nature and nurture combine to cause behavior, traits, and illnesses that genes alone can't explain, ranging from sexual orientation to autism to cancer. "We were all brought up to think the genome was it," said Rockefeller University molecular biologist David Allis. "It's really been a watershed in understanding that there is something beyond the genome." What is epigenetics? The word literally means on top of genetics, and it's the study of how individual genes can be activated or deactivated by life experiences. Each one of our cells, from skin cells to neurons, contains an identical DNA blueprint, yet they perform vastly different functions. That's because epigenetic tags block developing fetal cells from following any genetic instructions that don't pertain to their intended roles. That biochemical process, scientists have discovered, occurs not just during gestation and early development, but throughout adulthood, switching genes on or off and altering our mental and our physical health. How does that affect who we are? We're only beginning to find out. A woman's diet during pregnancy seems to have a major impact on her baby's epigenetic tags. Prenatal diets that are low in folic acid, vitamin B12, and other nutrients containing methyl groups, a set of molecules that can tag genes and cause epigenetic changes, have been linked to an increased risk of asthma and brain and spinal cord defects in children. Stress, too, can alter fetal epigenetic tags. Pregnant women who were traumatized at the World Trade Center on 9/11 were far more likely than other women to give births to infants who reacted with unusual levels of fear and stress when faced with loud noises, unfamiliar people, or new foods. Can changes occur later in life? Absolutely. Young children who are abused are more likely to have epigenetic changes that make coping with stress more difficult. Twins may inherit a gene that predisposes them to cancer, but only one will develop the disease because diet, toxins, or smoking turn on that gene, while the other has different habits and goes cancer-free. We're not completely at the mercy of our genes, writes health journalist Alice Walton. In many ways, they are at the mercy of our health and lifestyle decisions and habits. Are epigenetic changes hereditary? To the consternation of strict Darwinists, they can be. Researchers used to think that when a sperm and egg combined, all their epigenetic tags were erased, leaving the resulting embryo with a clean slate. Now they know that about 1% of our epigenetic tags escape erasure and pass directly to our offspring, and potentially their offspring and beyond. Scientists have discovered, for instance, that a group of children conceived during the Netherlands' desperate wartime famine of 1944 and 45 tended themselves to have smaller-than-usual offspring. That suggests that what men and women eat and smoke and what toxins and traumas they're exposed to can affect their children and even grandchildren. University of Texas zoologist David Cruz has done multi-generational studies with rats that led him to speculate that soaring obesity and autism rates could be due to our grandparents' exposure to the chemical revolution of the 1940s, including the introduction of new plastics, fertilizers, detergents, and pesticides. Are these insights yielding medical therapies? Over the past 5 years, evidence that epigenetics plays a major role in cancer has become absolutely rock solid, says Robert Weinberg, a biologist at the Whitehead Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrew Feinberg, director of Johns Hopkins University Epigenetics Center, thinks it's a factor in autism and diabetes as well. Drugs are in the works aimed at undoing cancerous epigenetic changes. Even eating foods rich in gene-altering methyl groups, such as soybeans, red grapes, and green tea, might protect against disease by silencing detrimental genes. In one famous experiment, researchers fed a methyl-rich diet to pregnant female mice that carried a gene that made them fat, yellow, and prone to cancer and diabetes. Though their offspring carried the same gene, they were born slim, brown, and disease-free. But researchers are still trying to work out how to use this powerful tool to address specific health problems. Did this change in diet increase cancer risk? Asked McGill University pharmacologist Moshe Sif. Did it increase depression? Did it increase dementia or Alzheimer's? We don't know yet, and it will take some time to sort it out. The footnote to today's briefing section on the switches on your genes is entitled Darwin versus Lamarck. Before Darwin laid out the principles of natural selection in On the Origin of Species, an 18th century French naturalist, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, proposed a very different theory of evolution. Organisms, he thought, could pass on traits they'd acquired over their lifetime. Lamarckism, typified by the incorrect idea that giraffes have long necks because they're constantly stretching them to reach high leaves, faced ridicule after Darwinism took hold. At the turn of the 20th century, August Weismann debunked the theory by chopping off the tails of mice to prove that their pups would not inherit their taillessness. But even though Darwin was 100% right about how creatures evolve, and Swiss bioengineer Renato Pero, epigenetics suggests that the Frenchman may have been on to something after all. Passing on gained characteristics, he said, fits more to Lamarck's theory of evolution. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine for this week. The first one is entitled Setting a New Tone for the GOP by Frank Luntz in the Washington Post. Republicans need to watch their language, said GOP consultant Frank Luntz. In polls, my firm has found that most voters now identify Republicans as the party of the wealthy and big business rather than hardworking taxpayers, and it's killing us at election time. Republicans' harsh, disdainful language is a big part of the problem. You don't win elections by mocking the food stamp nation, saying illegal immigrants should be forced to self-deport, or warning that if Social Security and Medicare aren't cut, you'll shut down the government. Such angry, out-of-touch language conveys a lack of empathy, especially in contrast with President Obama's rhetorical emphasis on fairness and the middle class. The basic Republican idea that personal responsibility is better than government dependency resonates deeply in the American electorate. But if the GOP wants to win the battle of ideas, it should stop talking about job creators and small government and become the party of hardworking taxpayers and efficient government. As Ronald Reagan knew so well, conservatism thrives only when it's infused with optimism. The next column is entitled The Smearing of Zero Dark 30 by Kenneth Turin in the Los Angeles Times. Zero Dark 30 is the victim of a smear campaign, said Kenneth Turin. The film, which depicts the U.S.'s long pursuit and eventual killing of Osama bin Laden with mesmerizing realism, has won near-universal raves from critics and audiences. But when the Oscar nominations came out last week, Zero Dark 30 got only 5, compared with 12 for Lincoln, and Catherine Bigelow was shut out of Best Director contention. Why? Her film has become collateral damage in the political debate over the morality of torture. 3 U.S. senators have expressed their deep disappointment that the film supposedly justifies torture, while other critics have called Bigelow an apologist for evil. Academy voters caved in to the drumbeat of condemnation, even though the critics are wrong. Far from justifying torture, Zero Dark 30 shows waterboarding and other interrogation techniques as brutal and repellent. It's ambiguous as to whether tortured prisoners give up any information critical to finding bin Laden, while Bigelow makes it clear that our country lost its moral compass in our post-9/11 panic. Her film's nuanced artistry deserves praise, not shunning. And the third column from this week in the Week magazine, Why Should You Get a Flu Shot? By Michael Spector in NewYorker.com. Let's try an experiment, said Michael Spector. Turn to whomever you are with and say these sentences out loud. I never wear seatbelts, and I never get killed in car crashes. I never use condoms, and I never become infected with sexually transmitted diseases. Stupid, right? Yet when it comes to getting flu shots, most Americans take a position no less irrational and short-sighted. As the flu rampages across the country this winter, sending thousands to hospitals and killing the elderly and children, fewer than 40% of Americans have received the flu vaccine. Some people falsely think the shot itself could give them the flu. It can't, since the viruses in the vaccine have not been inactivated. Others simply think it's not worth the trouble to get the shot. Even if you think you are invincible, your elderly neighbors and infant children are not. Your parents and grandparents are not. Every year, in fact, the influenza virus kills about 45,000 Americans. So for your own sake and that of those you love, go get a shot today. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll flip to the last word in this January 25th edition. It's entitled The Frozen Ocean. What fuels a dog sled race across the Russian tundra, says Julia Phillips, is booze, anger, and desire. How do you see what the mushers see? You mush. Turn in an application to the Beringia, a dog sled race stretching 685 miles over Russia's easternmost tundra. In March, make your way to the village of Esso in the remote Kamchatka Peninsula, nearly 5,000 miles from Moscow. Meet your competitors. Check your dog's harnesses one last time. Lift the toothed snow anchor that was holding your sled in place and mush. If you're not a musher, you can still make it across those 685 miles of snow. You just have to figure out how. Here's my advice. Live in Kamchatka's capital city, speak English, write articles, and be patient. One morning, you'll find you're in the right place at finally the right time. The race leader says you can accompany the crew as a writer. Get your sleeping bag, ski mask, and pens, and get to Esso. This year's race, featuring 16 mushers, preparation for the start drew on until just when it seemed unbearable. Then, in a clamor of shouts and barks and cheers, the bearded judge checked his watches. He signaled 16 times for the staggered start. The sleds were off. The race had begun. Imagine the desert, white dunes, white peaks, white sun, white sky. Imagine a frozen ocean. This was the tundra. I had never seen such emptiness in my life. I couldn't stop staring around. It was far below freezing, and in my thermal underwear, fleece layer, snowsuit, face masks, hat, and shearling mittens, my skin prickled as gently as it once did when I sat on summer afternoons in air-conditioned movie theaters. Let's be clear, I had no qualifications for such a trip, which took nearly 3 weeks and covered a mostly unpopulated wilderness. People in the capital, when hearing about my plans with the Beringia, had asked me, "Do you understand it's very difficult?" It seemed to me that I did. I'd never gutted a fish, peeled potatoes with a knife, or ridden on a snowmobile, but soon I'd learn. Sitting on the back of a snowmobile was a roaring, swooping, unsteady motion I came to love. We sat on reindeer pelts culled from the herds that climb Kamchatka's peaks, and under my legs the fur bunched. The first time a snowmobile driver slid off the track, I wasn't paying attention, and discovered myself flying nose first into him. "What were you thinking back there?" he said lightly. I had been staring at the mountains, at the snow. Walking through the tundra was an experiment in flatness. Around the little cabin where we'd set up camp, tiny figures rose up in motion. After 58 miles, the long-anticipated mushers, one by one, were finishing for the day. The mushers were hungry, exhausted, and wonderful. They got short with the volunteers. There must always, always be boiling water for dishes and thermoses and endless cups of black tea. And when there wasn't any ready, the mushers jammed up against the cement stove and started growling. We all shared soup. The mushers ate first. They swallowed condensed milk by the spoonful, then poured water into the emptied cans and drank the dregs. Around me, they talked about old adventures. The snowmobile that fell into the river, remember? The team that got lost for 4 days in a blizzard? The fish they'd caught, the animals they'd shot. An hour before the next start, a musher went out in the soft white morning. From a plastic tub full of fat used for milking cows, she worked yellow cream into the pads of the dog's paws, because without such a layer, snow melts against their feet, freezes and makes a case of ice that slowly fills with blood. "Give me your little paw, my sweet boy," she murmured, and velcroed booties to their lotioned feet. Untangling their chains from frozen branches, the musher led her dogs one by one to the sled. Each was slipped into a hand-tooled harness with the animal's name stitched inside. She lined them up and let them go. At every start, dogs lunge toward the unwound trail before snapping back against their lines. A good team of huskies wants to run. A perfect team frightens its owner. One snowmobile driver who had won the Beringia years before told the story of the ideal animals he'd bred. At the start of his final race, 7 men had to hold his sled back before the judge's signal. The dogs were in a frenzy, straining against their ropes, clawing the snow and screaming. Anchors and brakes and his will were useless. He'd felt their strength ripple backward and known he was no longer in control. "I gave them away after that," he said. "They would have killed me." One day hit minus 39 degrees. Cracking open a hard-boiled egg for breakfast, I found a layer of rippled ice beneath its shell. Frost cased over our eyelashes. After 2 weeks of cold, the snowmobile's faces began to blister. The edges of their nostrils cracked open. They bled. When we arrived in the next village, townspeople were drifting the packed snow, trailing the sharp smell of alcohol from their open mouths. The Beringia operates under a dry law. Still, it has a long history of tying sodden participants to trees so they wouldn't attack anyone. In theory, any member of the group could have been expelled for drinking, although in practice people carried flasks and stashed bottles under their seats. One blacked-out snowmobile driver drove a wavering quarter mile before he was pushed to his own passenger seat and someone else took over the controls. No one mentioned it to the organizers, who in turn pretended not to already know. Competition came and went. The mushers slept pressed side by side like baby mice. But as the days grew on, the race grew harsher between them all. This one, that one was cheating. He shaved off a mile by leaving the trail. She refused to admit that she stole 2 dogs. He was switching out his tired animals in every town. They reported each other. Some were docked minutes. There were disputed friendships, soured friendships, years of anger, old affairs, rivalries, jealousies, sport, sex. Sex, always sex. Despite our padded snowsuits and the fact that no one had bathed in ages, the Beringia was ruled by desire. My notes became not much more than a catalog of touches, winks, and suggestions. I'd pictured this event as a race, then as an expedition, but at times, in truth, it seemed only like a mat of intimacies and betrayals. Because I could hardly speak, people came to me with their secrets, one about marriage, another about disease. I promised not to tell, so I won't, but riding on the back of a snowmobile through an entirely white world, I thought, who cares about connections? Who cares about confidences? We slept on reindeer skins that smelled like vanilla tobacco. We lashed tarps and smashed sleds. I scraped lines of black blood from the spines of frozen fish and watched my hands turn from red to purple to white from the cold, and I loved it. And then I was left behind. No, I told an organizer in a hallway 250 miles from the end. "I'm here to write about the race, you understand, that if I don't see it all, I lose my story. I lose everything." "Zira," I kept saying in Russian, which means in vain. "In vain I've shaped my life these past few weeks around your appetites. In vain I've arrived here with my notebooks and knives only to be abandoned. Zira." Another organizer, who was also being left, said, "Can't you just make the end of your story up?" Covering my face with my dry palms, I got hysterical. The race was dropping volunteers to make room for extra fuel. After a week, a helicopter would bring 4 of us to the race finish. Gutted, I stood outside without my jacket to watch the yellow oil barrels being secured to trailers. When the organizers were finally pulling on their masks, I plucked at the race leader's sleeve. "Take me, please," I begged, but he didn't. The four of us stood at our base's door and lifted our palms in farewell, and the departing volunteers waved back, and then they were gone. We went inside. My heart was broken. I would never see what the mushers saw. The first was so angry. It wasn't his fault. He'd been pushed into this blood rage by the race organizers, the regional bureaucrats, the mushers who wouldn't talk to him, the people that didn't love him, his dogs that refused to cooperate, his ex-wife. He shoved his sled forward in hate. The second finished in third place, years ago, and now he was coming in second to last. What did he care? The race gave him food and shelter and a month-long tour through the wilderness. The third dropped out, the fourth got sick, the fifth couldn't stop crying. The sixth had already run this expedition a dozen times. The seventh passed out holy water in the villages and blasphemed on the track. The eighth had been this competition's champion long before she herself began participating. The ninth was racing toward his 50th birthday, the last day of the race. The tenth was running near the back of the pack, but she still seemed like a winner. The 11th would race this length and then mush another 600 miles home. The 12th thanked God, thanked him for the packed powder underfoot, good health, bright sun. Thanked God he won this year. He won. He did it. Thank God. The 13th shouted at his dogs, "Catch up, catch up." The 14th put his arms around the other's shoulders and slurred against their ears. The 15th sent the rest of the racers running in fear. Hunched on their sled runners, they called, "How far away is the 15th musher? How many minutes?" He came at them like a storm. Though he finished second this year, he blew into the finish line grinning. The 16th's dogs refused to move. A metal-tipped pole, cold in his glove, the 16th musher rose from his sled. Knowing the pole's weight, his dogs, shrinking, began to cry. Open the windows of the helicopter, that's my advice to you. A mile up, slide open the portholes so snow can settle against your feet and your broken heart can rattle in your rib cage. In the tundra, at the top of a peninsula, at the far eastern edge of an enormous country, return to the Beringia and feel that you are coming home. Kiss the cheeks of the tired racers. Black and yellow ribbons mark 685 miles of beaten snow at your back. After 20 days, the race has reached its final finish line in Osora, leaving in its wake iron crosses, donated clothing, dog urine, and stripped reindeer bones. Did you get your story after all? Yes. No. Chase this race forever. Return in 11 months. Want now, most of all, to be back on the endless Beringia. And the article was originally published in online magazine, themorningnews.org, and was reprinted with permission. Now, from the last word, we'll turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Visitors from Outer Space. Near misses by comets and asteroids are rare events, but in 2013, Earthlings will experience at least three. A menacing 1,000-foot-wide asteroid named Apophis had last week passed within 9 million miles of our planet, close by astronomical standards. Dubbed the Doomsday Asteroid, Apophis has an elliptical orbit around the Sun that will bring it much closer to Earth in 2036. Since its orbit was not precisely calculated, there had been fears it might strike us on that next visit. A catastrophic impact that would be equivalent to 25,000 atomic bombs. But after closely analyzing Apophis's trajectory on last week's flyby, NASA says it has now completely excluded any chance of impact in 2036. In February, a smaller asteroid, about 150 feet in diameter, will miss Earth by a mere 21,600 miles, only about one-tenth the distance from Earth to the Moon. November could bring the most spectacular visitor of all, what astronomers are calling the comet of the century. If the newly discovered comet, named ISON, I-S-O-N, does not break up as it swings around the sun, its tail, formed by gases and dust boiling off its icy surface, could be as bright in the night sky as a full moon. Comet watcher John Bortle tells NBCNews.com that ISON may have a tail of amazing length and surface brightness, unmatched by any since the Great Comet of 1680. Asteroids and comets are cosmic debris left over from the birth of our solar system about 4.5 billion years ago. The next item from the Health and Science section is entitled Your Elusive Future Self. Most of us acknowledge that our values, preferences, and personalities have changed quite a bit from a decade ago. But when asked to project 10 years into the future, a new Harvard University study has found we assume we'll be exactly the same, if a bit more wrinkled, what researchers are calling the end of history illusion. Psychologist Daniel Gilbert and colleagues surveyed more than 19,000 people between the ages of 18 and 68 and found that the vast majority were unable to imagine changing as much in the future as they readily admitted they had in the past. All of us seem to have this sense that development is a process that has delivered us to this point, and now we're done, Gilbert tells LiveScience.com. Younger people were particularly prone to believing that what they thought and valued now would hold true throughout their lives. The end of history illusion helps to explain why people get ill-advised tattoos, marry questionable partners, or make financial planning decisions they come to regret. People really aren't very good at knowing who they're going to be, and hence what they're going to want a decade from now, Gilbert says. At every age, we think we're having the last laugh, and at every age, we're wrong. The next item, are cows part reptile? Cows have some DNA they apparently borrowed from snakes, a surprising finding that indicates that genes can travel between species. Molecular biologists analyzing the cow genome discovered that 25% of its DNA had originated in a reptile, possibly a snake. Scientists have long known that DNA can travel between microbes, but the lateral transfer of genes between species has never been observed in more complex creatures. The reptilian DNA segments may have hitchhiked on a virus that infected a cow or been transmitted by a tick that bit a snake and then a cow. These jumping genes continue to replicate themselves within the new species, but there's no evidence they express themselves as traits, University of Adelaide molecular biologist David Adelson tells Mother Jones. A cow, in other words, doesn't look or act like a snake, despite some common DNA. The findings suggest that nature has been shuffling bits of DNA between species for the last couple of 100 million years, Adelson says. He plans to study whether the human genome also contains jumping genes from other species. And the final article in the Health and Science section, the Health Scare of the Week, Alcoholism Among Women. Binge drinking is a serious problem for American women and girls, a new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report shows. Some 1 in 8 women over the age of 18 says she drinks as many as 6 drinks a night, 3 times per month. And 1 in 5 high school girls admitted she binged within the past year. Binge drinking is defined as 4 or more drinks per sitting for women and 5 for men. The findings are especially alarming, CDC researcher Robert Brewer tells CBSNews.com, because women tend to be smaller and therefore are more susceptible to the harms of alcohol at lower levels of drinking. Excessive drinking plays a role in the deaths of about 23,000 women and girls per year. Alcohol also increases the risk of breast cancer, heart disease, and sexually transmitted diseases. Experts say women should drink no more than 3 drinks daily and no more than 7 per week to avoid alcohol-related illness. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled Baseball, Steroids, and the Hall of Fame. In the end, said Hampton Stevens in the Atlantic.com, cheaters lose. That old-fashioned principle was upheld last week by the Baseball Writers Association of America, which for the first time since 1996 elected no former players to baseball's Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Among those rightly snubbed were Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, unquestionably the best hitter and pitcher of their era, whose achievements were later tainted by revelations that they used performance-enhancing drugs, such as steroids and human growth hormones. The baseball writers got it right, said the New York Times in an editorial. Letting players with artificially enhanced statistics into the Hall of Fame would diminish the legends who got there honestly. It would also be an insult to those players who stayed clean during the 1990s and early 2000s and whose excellence was unfairly dimmed by the bulked-up competition. The baseball writers got it wrong, said the Chicago Tribune. It's one thing to exclude known juicers like Bonds, who set both single-season and career home run records after gaining so much muscle he looked like a cartoon character. But the voters also snubbed muscular sluggers Mike Piazza and Jeff Bagwell, who were merely rumored to have used some chemical assistance. What happened to being innocent until proven guilty? Since literally hundreds of players used steroids during that era, said Alan Barra in the DailyBeast.com. We can never be sure who was dirty and who was clean. If the guardians of baseball's integrity are going to ban anyone even suspected of drug use, then the only fair way to go is to institute a total ban on everyone who played during the steroid era. The next item is entitled Freak Weather, Proof of Climate Change. Even in a world where extreme weather is becoming more common, said Sarah Lyle in the New York Times, the past week has been truly bizarre. In China, now suffering through its coldest, harshest winter in memory, the roofs of houses in Zhenjiang collapsed under the weight of deep snow. It was so hot in Australia, meanwhile, that forecasters added new colors to weather maps to show temperatures over 130 degrees. Israel, a desert nation, saw snow turn its olive groves white. In Anchorage, January temperatures hit a freakishly warm 42 degrees and melting snow inundated city streets. These anomalies begin to add up, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. It's now official that 2012 was the hottest year on record in the continuous U.S., topping 1998 by an astonishing one full degree. And just as climatologists predicted, the man-made warming of the atmosphere is producing crazy weather extremes throughout the globe. Now can we talk about climate change? Why bother when global warming has ceased, said Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. Even if 2012 was hot in the U.S., the warmest year on record for the entire globe remains 1998. And no trend has been apparent globally since then. Advocates of climate change are fond of cherry-picking data and extreme weather events that support their argument while ignoring contrary data. Now that global warming has failed to materialize, said James Dellingpole in the telegraph.co.uk, activists have moved on to global weirding, which allows them to cite any unusual weather as ironclad evidence of climate change, but acting unpredictably is what weather does by nature all the time. The denialists claim that there has been no warming since 1998 is blatantly untrue, said Phil Flate in Slate.com. The rate of warming since then has fluctuated, but 9 of the 10 hottest years on record have been since 2000. The proof is visible. Sea ice in the Arctic is vanishing, and glaciers in the Antarctic and Greenland are melting with catastrophic implications. Let this be clear. There is no scientific controversy over this. Unfortunately, President Obama is still waiting for a politically opportune time to address climate change, said Bill McKibben in Salon.com. Physics is entirely uninterested in human timetables. If we don't limit our fossil fuel emissions soon, we'll find ourselves in a planetary emergency. And now as we get closer to the end of the program this week, let's take a look at a few short notes from the Talking Points section. Americans under the age of 50 are more likely to have poor health and die prematurely than people in 16 other developed countries, according to a new study by the National Research Council. Car accidents, gun violence, obesity, diabetes, and drug overdoses are the leading contributors to the U.S.'s comparatively low life expectancy among the countries in the study, including Canada, Australia, and the nations of Western Europe. The model daily schedule recommended to new members of Congress by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee allots 4 hours a day to making phone calls to potential donors and 1 to 2 hours to meeting with constituents. In India, about 100,000 women are burned to death each year by husbands or families. Another 125,000 die from injuries inflicted in domestic violence that is never reported to the police. The average office worker spends 650 hours a year, 28% of working hours, reading and writing emails. The total number of words in those emails, 41,400, is equivalent to a novel 166 pages long. And about 80,000 people were caught lying about prior criminal records when attempting to buy a gun in 2010. Only 44 of them were charged with a crime. And now let's look at the poll watch from the Week magazine for this week. 88% of Americans support requiring background checks on people buying guns at gun shows. 65% support banning high-capacity ammunition clips, and 58% support a ban on assault weapons. Americans also support a law requiring an armed guard in every school in the nation by a 55% to a 42% margin. And 33% of Americans admit they've already broken or cheated on their New Year's resolutions. How about you? We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.